An Osho Talk. The Path of Love. Talks on the Songs of Kabir, number 8.
The first question. Is there a life after death? This is a wrong question, basically meaningless. One should never jump ahead of oneself. There is every possibility you will fall on your face. One should ask the basic question. One should begin from the beginning. My suggestion is, ask a more basic question. For example, you can ask, is there life after birth? That will be more basic. Because many people are born, but very few people have life. Just by being born, you are not alive. You exist certainly, but life is more than mere existence. You are born, but unless you are reborn into your being, you don't live, you never live. Birth is necessary but not enough. Something more is needed. Otherwise, one simply vegetates. One simply dies. Of course, it is a very gradual death, and you are so unaware that you never know it. You never become aware of it. From birth to death, it is a long progression of death. It is very rare to come across an alive person. A Buddha, a Jesus, a Kabir, they are alive. And this is the miracle, that those who are alive, they never ask the question, is there life after death? They know it. They know what life is. And in that knowing, death has disappeared. Once you know what life is, death exists not. Death exists only because you don't know what life is. Because yet you are unaware of life, its deathlessness. You have not touched life, hence the fear of death exists. Once you have known what life is, in that very moment, death has become non-existential. Bring light into the dark room and the darkness disappears. No life and death disappears. A person who is really alive simply laughs at the very possibility of death. Death is impossible. Death cannot exist in the very nature of things. That which is will remain, has remained always. That which is cannot disappear. But not theoretically. You have to come existentially to this experience. Ordinarily, this question remains in the mind, whether you ask it or not. The question, what happens after death? Because nothing has happened before death. That's why the question. Because life has not happened even after birth. How can you believe and trust that life is going to happen even after death? It has not happened after birth. How it can happen after death? And one who knows life knows that death is another birth and nothing else. Death is another birth. A new door opens. Death is the other side of the same door you call birth. From one side the door is known as death, from another side the door is known as birth. Death brings another birth, another beginning, another journey. But this will be just a speculation to you. This will not mean much unless you know what life is. That's why I say, ask the right question. A wrong question cannot be answered, or it can be answered only in a wrong way. A wrong question presupposes a wrong answer. I am here to help you to know something, not to help you to become great speculators, thinkers. Experience is the goal, not philosophizing. And only experience solves the riddle. You are born, but not yet really born. A rebirth is needed. You have to be twice born. The first birth is only the physical birth. The second birth is the real birth, the spiritual birth. You have to come to know yourself, who you are. You have to ask this question, who am I? And while life is there, why not inquire into life itself? Why bother about death? When it comes, you can face it and you can know it. Don't miss this opportunity of knowing life while life surrounds you. If you have known life, you would have known certainly death. And then death is not the enemy. Death is the friend. Then death is nothing but a deep sleep. Again there is a morning. Again things will start. Then death is nothing but rest, a tremendous rest, needed rest, after the whole lives of toil and tiredness. One needs a great rest into God. Death is going back to the source. Just like as sleep is, every night you die. A little death. You call it a sleep. Better it would be to call it a little death. You disappear from the surface. You move into your innermost being. You are lost. You don't know who you are. You forget all about the world and the relationship and the people. You die a small death, a tiny death. But even that tiny death revives you. In the morning you are full of zest and juice again. Again throbbing with life. Again ready to jump into 1001 adventures. Ready to take the challenge. By the evening you will be tired again. This is daily happening. You have not even known what sleep is. How can you know death? Death is a great sleep. Great rest after the whole life. It makes you anew. It makes you fresh. It resurrects you. The second question, the owner of the Grand Hotel where I am living would like an answer to this question. Why did God create this world? First, never bring anybody else questions to me. Bring the questioner. Because I cannot answer anybody else's question. The questioner has to be here in my presence. Because deep down my presence is the answer, not what I say, but what I am. Never bring borrowed questions. If it is not yours, it is meaningless. You tell the owner of your hotel, you can come. And if he is really interested, he should come. I don't think he is interested in God or in anything. Maybe curious. But curious people are just stupid. Any stupid person can be curious. To be really an inquirer, one needs great intelligence. Now, if he is interested, I am here in Pune, and he runs a hotel here, you are here from faraway countries, and he has not come, he is not interested. He is just curious. He is not ready to stake anything, not even coming here. It is not very costly to come here. He could have come. And he knows you coming every day here, and he knows that you are a sannyasin. He knows that you have staked your life, you have gambled with your life, and he has not become even interested. Never bring such questions to me. This type of questions are foolish. They cannot be answered. Because unless you ask intensely, unless you ask from the very core of your being, the question is irrelevant. The question becomes relevant only when you are behind it and you are ready to do something for it. You are ready to pay for it. God is not available to such people. They are not ready to pay anything. They want God very cheap. They want God second hand. Now you will listen to my answer and then you will go and tell him. First, you don't know. You will not listen to what I say. You are bound to carry some wrong message. Of course, your mind will come in. You will distort it. You will add something, you will delete something in it. You will color it by your own mind, with your own interpretation. And then you will take it to him. It is already dead. You have killed it. Then you go and give it to him. And if in this way inquiries are possible, then books are available. He should go and consult a library. All answers are written there. And he must have read something. Otherwise the question would not arise. He must have heard the word God. Never do these things. If somebody asks such a question, drag him to me. Tell him you come and you face this man directly. But I suspect that the question is yours and not the owner of the hotel. But you are not courageous enough to say that it is yours. People are so ashamed even of asking authentic questions. Why people are so ashamed? Because to ask a question proves that you are ignorant. So people would like to hide behind somebody else's back. Now this owner of the Grand Hotel is a perfect place to hide. People feel a little ashamed when they ask a question. Because the very idea that I am asking a question means that I don't know. Once it happened, a man came to me and he said, "My friend has become important. Can you suggest something?" I said, "It will be better you send your friend and he can say the truth that his friend has become important." Why you bothered? You could have sent the friend and he could have said the truth that his friend has become important. You are not even potent enough to ask a question. Why bring this friend in? The first thing when you ask a question is to recognize your ignorance. From there the inquiry starts. A question is beautiful when the questioner knows that I don't know. Then a question is healthy. Because the mother is healthy and the question is the child of you. When you say, "I don't know," and "I ask because I don't know," then the question is tremendously healthy, alive. It's heart beating, it breathes. And I love an alive question. Then something can be done. Now you bring a dead question. Because you cannot accept the fact that you don't know. You know perfectly well this owner of the Grand Hotel. He is ignorant, he is asking. That's why I am going to answer, because I know it is your question. Why did God create this world? First thing, it may be a surprise to you that God never created this world. This world is your creation. God has created a world, but you don't know about that world at all. This world, He has not created at all. This world where Richard Nixon exists, where Vietnam exists, where Idi Amin Dada exists. This world God has not created. This world of Adolf Hitler's and Mussolini's and fascism and communism and Stalin and Mao. This world God has not created. This world where such tremendous poverty exists because people are so greedy, because people go on hoarding. This world where such ugly life exists, where not even a shower of love happens, desert-like, loveless. People just competing, fighting, conflicting, where such immense violence exists. This world God has not created. This is your world. You are the creator of it. You are this world. This world is your projection. This world vibrates on your ugliness. So first thing, God has not created this world. Please don't make Him responsible for it. He is not. Otherwise, He would be the greatest criminal if He has created this world. At least I, for one, declare that he has not created this world. This is your creation. But you will say, and logically too, that he has created us. And if we create this world, then finally he is responsible. No. Still I say he is not responsible, because he has created you as freedom. That is the thing to be understood. This ugly world won't exist if God has created you as slaves. If God has created you as robots, mechanisms, then this ugly world would not have existed. Then you all would have been Buddhas, but meaningless Buddhas. If a Buddha cannot be an Adolf Hitler, if the very possibility is denied, then the Buddha is just a statue, meaningless. If you have to be good and there is no freedom to be bad, then what is the point of being good? The world would have been good if God has not created you as freedoms. If he had forced you to be just mechanical repetitions, gramophone records, then you would have been delivering Sermon on the Mount or Bhagavad Gita. But if gramophone record is a gramophone record, God has created you as freedom. Of course, in freedom, the opposite is implied. Good you can do if you choose. Bad you can do if you choose that way. And choice is yours. God has given you all freedom to choose. That is the glory of man and the agony. The glory because man is free. Can't you see it? A tree is not free. A rose bush is a rose bush. Whatsoever is going to happen is already predestined. The rosebush is not free. If it decides not to grow roses, nothing will happen. Roses will come still. If the rosebush decides to change the color of the roses, nothing will happen. The rose will remain of the same color as before. If the rosebush decides to become a lotus plant, nothing will happen. The rosebush will remain a rosebush. It is destined to be a rosebush. It is beautiful, but not free. That's why I say, nothing can be compared to man's beauty. Even roses are nothing compared to man's beauty. Because a rose has to be a rose. It is in a sort of bondage. It cannot do otherwise. It cannot go astray. It has to be a saint. It has to be a Jesus. It cannot be a Judas. That's why a rosebush is just a rosebush. Good to look at, but nothing to be compared with the beauty of human beings. The beauty comes because a person can be a Jesus or a person can be a Judas. And everybody carries both the possibilities, Jesus and the Judas. Everybody is totally free, and the range is big, the whole spectrum. Man is a rainbow, all the colors. Man is not predestined. Hence, we have created this world out of our freedom. The responsibility is ours. If you want to become a Buddha, you can become. Nobody can force you to become a Buddha. If you want to become a Chinggis Khan, you can become a Chinggis Khan. The choice is yours. God is not dragging you anywhere. He has given you enough rope. You can go astray. You can come back. Because of this possibility of going astray, this world exists. This world can be changed, can be utterly changed. Once we change our consciousness, this world can become a totally different affair. You ask, why did God create this world? So first thing, He has not created this world. He has created you. He has created human freedom. And one should feel grateful that He has made you free. Otherwise, if you are forced to become a Jesus, then to be a Jesus is mechanical, meaningless. There is no significance, no poetry in it. Because you can miss the target. The Christian word sin is very significant. Its original root means missing the target. The original root from the word sin comes means missing the target. You can miss. It is up to you. Sin is missing the target. It is going astray. And God will not prevent you. His love is so infinite that He will love you even if you have gone astray. He loves the sinners as much as the saints. And if you listen to Jesus, Jesus says He loves the sinners even more. Because they need more love. Have you not watched it? If a child is ill, the mother cares more about the ill child than the healthy child. Naturally so. It is justified. The healthy is healthy, so there is no need for the mother to be over careful. But the ill is ill. The mother sits by the side of the bed, massages the child, takes more care. Jesus says God cares more for the sinners, those who have missed the target. He goes on showering His mercy on them. This world is our going astray, our sin. It has nothing to do with God. Second thing, why did God create this world? Second thing, in the Christian, in the Judaic, in the Mohammedan world, a very wrong conception exists about God. As if He is separate from His creation. As if one day He created the world and then forgot all about it. As if God is a painter. The painting is finished and the painting becomes separate from the painter. No. The East knows far better. The East says God is not separate from His creation. The Creator is not separate from His creation. He is involved in it. He is in it. He is it. Creator is creation. That's why I insist again and again, don't call God the Creator. Call Him creativity. God is a dynamic creativity. Creator is a dead concept. As if someday He finished. That's what Christians go on thinking. In 6 days He created the world and the seventh day He rested. In 6 days finished. Then what He is doing since then? He must be getting very much tired, not doing anything. He must be getting fed up. He must be bored. Have mercy on Him. He is not finished yet. The creation is never finished. It is an ongoing process. The creation is never complete. And God goes on and on and on. He is not finished with it. If He is finished with it, then that will be the end. He is still involved. He is still in love. He is still painting. He is still sculpturing. He still hopes. Rabindranath has said that whenever I see a new baby born, I look at the sky and say, God still hopes. A new baby is a hope. Of course, he failed with the old generation, so he creates a new generation. He says, let us see, maybe this time I will succeed. His optimism is infinite. He is like a poet who goes on composing new poems every day. Every day he feels a little satisfied and a little dissatisfied. Satisfied because something has happened in the poetry, something has been caught, a ray of light. But something is still missing. Tomorrow morning, another try. Rabindranath has written 6,000 poems, and when he was dying, an old friend said to him, you can die peacefully and in deep content because you are the greatest poet. Rabindranath opened his eyes and he said, stop nonsense. Right now I am telling to God what you are doing. I have been trying and trying and I have not yet succeeded. Much has happened, but I am not satisfied. And just now I was getting closer and closer. And this is the time to take me away. I was just getting closer to closer. And I was feeling just by the corner it is there. The poetry for which I have been trying. My 6,000 poetries are my 6,000 failures. Maybe the 6,001. And this is the time to take me away what you are doing. My whole life I have been trying and trying and trying, and now I feel the crescendo was coming and I was coming to the peak. And this is the moment you withdraw me. God is not yet finished. God still hopes. Hence we can also hope. In His hope is our hope too. He has not utterly failed. He still trusts you. He still goes on creating. So this concept of a dead creator somewhere in the past, Christian theologians are such foolish that they have even decided the date and the year. 4,004 years before Jesus Christ, He created the world. On a certain Monday, of course. Early in the sixth morning, when you start the dynamic meditation, He started this whole dynamism. Early in the morning, 6 o'clock, He must have fixed the clock with an alarm. It is all foolish. Creation is timeless. It has been always there. It will always be there. Because God is creation. God is creativity. So I never call God a painter. I call Him a dancer. When the painting is finished, the painter is separate, the painting is separate. In dance, it is totally different. Dance is the most spiritual phenomenon. Because the dancer and the dance are one. You cannot separate them. The duality does not exist. There is a tremendous oneness. The dancer is the dance. The dance is the dancer. If you take away the dancer is no more a dancer. If the dancer stops, the dance stops. They are not two. God is as involved in his world as a dancer is involved in his dance. Hence I tell you to revere the world. Never condemn it. God is involved in it. God is present everywhere. That's what Kabir goes on saying. Feel the awe, the reverence, the wonder, because he is everywhere. He's still working. You can catch hold of him. He's still painting, he's still sculpting, he's still dancing. It is not something that happened somewhere in the past. It is happening right this moment. He is speaking through me. He is listening through you. The creation is still going on. It is never going to end. It is an endless journey. In fact, existence has no goal. It is a pure journey. The journey in itself is so beautiful. Who bothers for the goal? Saint Teresa has said, heaven is all the way to heaven. Heaven is all the way to heaven. Has he not said, I am the way? Such a beautiful assertion of tremendous import. Heaven is all the way to heaven. Don't wait for some heaven as a goal. Heaven is all the way to heaven. Has he not said, I am the way? God is the way, not the goal. God is here, not there. God is now, not then. God is in you, in me, all around. Only God is. So you cannot ask this question, why did God create this world? He never created it. He is still creating. And if you really want to know why, you go to the artists. Don't go to theologians and don't go to philosophers and don't go to pundits. Go to the artists. Go to a Van Gogh when he is painting and ask him why he is painting. Go to a dancer, hold his hand and ask him why you are dancing. Go to a singer and ask him why you are singing. And you will know the answer. Painter will shrug his shoulders. He will say, what else can I do? I love painting. Why? There is no why. I love painting. It is the way I am. It is the way I feel most happy to be. This is the only way I feel tremendously blessed. That's why. There is no other why. Ask a dancer why you are dancing. And he will say, what else one can do? Life is to dance. Or ask a lover why he is in love. Have you loved ever somebody? And if somebody comes and asks you why, what you will say? Will you have really any answer? Why you love? You will say, why? There is no question about it. That's the way I feel the best, at my very peak. That's the way I feel blooming. That's the way bliss happens to me. Now there is no question about bliss. If you are happy, you are happy. Nobody asks you why you are happy. Yes, if you are miserable, question is relevant. If you are miserable, somebody can ask why you are miserable, and the question is relevant, because misery is against nature. Something wrong is happening. When you are happy, nobody asks why are you happy, except few neurotics. There are people, I cannot deny the possibility. I have heard about a patient. The psychiatrist was bored with him. Of course, he was getting enough money out of him, but he was getting by and by about 3, 4, 5 years of psychoanalysis, and the man was repeating the same again and again and again. And the psychiatrist said, you do one thing, you go to the mountains for a few days, that will be very helpful. So the patient went to the mountains, and do you know what? Next day arrives a telegram to the psychiatrist. The patient says in the telegram, I am feeling very happy. Why? Feeling very happy. Why? Explanation is needed. No, happiness needs no explanation. Happiness is its own explanation. God is creating because that is the only way He can be happy. That is the only way He loves. That is the only way He sings. That's the only way He can be at all. Creation is His innermost nature. No why is needed. The third question, what is the difference between a monastery and an ashram? A lot of difference, a great difference. The difference is as much as in the West and the East. The difference is as much as in will and surrender. The monastery is a Western concept. You should never translate ashram as a monastery. That is corrupting the word ashram, destroying its whole meaning. A monastery is on the path of will. People are trying hard to know the truth, struggling hard to find God. The monastery is strenuous, tense. The very word ashram means rest, relaxation. The very word ashram means tremendously relaxed. An ashram is a place where you go to relax. The monastery is a place where you go to seek, to search. Monastery is aggressive, male. Ashram is female, passive. Ashram is effortless. A monastery is nothing but effort. In the monastery, you are working to achieve God. In an ashram, you are playing. That's the difference. The ashram is a fun. The monastery is very serious. The word monastery comes from the monk. The monk is a very serious man. He has renounced the world, renounced the wife, renounced the children, renounced this and that. The monk is very dry. Hence, all the old Western monasteries existed in the deserts. The great monasteries existed in the deserts, dry, dry inside, dry outside. No rest, no shade of a tree, no greenery, no flowers flowering. Just effulged and effulged and effulged, no oasis of rest. And the monk means a person who has decided to be lonely. The word monk means lonely, one who has decided to live on his own. That's why from the same root come monopoly, monogamy, monotony, the same root, one, alone. A monastery is a place where many people live in their lonelinesses, but they don't live together. The togetherness is not there. A monastery is not a community. People are there. Many people may be living there, but each is living lonely. Together they are lonely. It is not a community. Each is seeking God. Great effort has to be made. One has to be ascetic. One has to continuously flag one's own body. One has to torture. One has to fast. One has to destroy all attachment to the world. How can you relax? The world is a sin, and you are born in sin. How can you relax? How can you rest? How can you celebrate? You will be surprised. The word celebration comes from a root celer, and celer means fasting. In the old Western monasteries, when the monks were fasting, it was called they are celebrating. Now, a feast can be a celebration, but how a fast can be a celebration? But that's how. Fast was imposed as celebration. Torture, self-torture was thought to be prayer. The world is thought to be against God, so you have to leave the world if you want to achieve God. The ashram has a totally different perspective. The ashram means a community, a communion of people, of souls who are alike. You will be surprised. The modern Hindu ashram is not really Eastern, remember. The modern Hindu ashram is so much influenced by the Christian monastery that it is not Hindu at all. If you really want to have a glimpse of a Hindu ashram, you will have to go to the days of Vedas. The master was there, but the master was not a monk. He was a married man. He had wife. He had children. The ashram was his family. That's why the ashram was called Gurukul. Gurukul means the family of the master. He had children, he had wife, he lived a relaxed life, deep in the forest, deep in nature, in a spontaneous way of life. Unhurried, not searching but waiting. Not putting God against the world but enjoying the world because God is in it. And the disciples who lived with him, they were his family, Gurukula. It was not an institution, it was a family. They were children to him, his own kids. They may be older than him, that is not the point, but they were his kids. This community lived in a very deep, relaxed way, dancing, singing, feasting, celebrating. enjoying the nature, the stars, the moon, the sun, the morning, the evening, the day, the night, and listening to God's voice in nature. Hence the master had moved to the forest. It was not against the world, remember. When the Christian monk moves out of the world, he is against the world. When the Eastern sage moved to the forest, he moved because he is all for the world. And in the marketplace, the world has been so much corrupted and destroyed. Know the distance, the distinction. It is tremendous. The Eastern sage used to move into nature because there God is more present. Man has not yet interfered. It is difficult to find God on an asphalt road. Look however hard, you will not find even a glimpse. It is very difficult to find God in a factory. Difficult. Very difficult. Because the human noise is too much. The mechanical, the technological is too much. The natural has gone far away. I have heard there was a survey in London, and 1 million children reported that they have never seen a cow. Now this is too much. 1 million children have never seen a cow. How they will ever be able to understand what God is if you have never looked into the eyes of a cow? God is more crystal clear in the eyes of a cow than in the eyes of a Pope or a Shankaracharya. One million children have not seen a cow. Now these 1 million children will suffer tremendously. There are thousands and thousands of people who have never seen the Himalayas, the snow-covered peaks, the eternal snow, virgin, never treaded upon. There God is still more present, is more throbbing, alive. Man has not destroyed yet. The Eastern sages moved into the forest, not because they were against the world, but because they wanted to know really the world that God has created, uninterfered by man. When the Christians move to a monastery, they move against the world because the world is a place of sin. They both move, but they both move for different reasons, diametrically opposite. And the Eastern word ashrama is beautiful. It means rest. You have lived in the world. You have known the world. Now to rest, you go to an ashram. You have seen the world, the ugliness of it, the futility of it, the uselessness of it, the meaninglessness of it. Now you would like to rest. Now you go deep into the forest. You sit under the shaded trees. You listen to the murmur of the brooks and the song of the birds. And you see the sun rays playing on the treetops in the morning. And you watch the silent stars. You relax. You by and by relax into your nature by the help of the nature outside you. It becomes a harmony, the inner nature and the outer nature. You start playing with the outer nature. It is not a seeking. Hindu ashrama is not a seeking. It is a place to rest. Seek and you will never find. Because the very seeking makes you tense. The East says, seek not and he will find you. Seek and you will never find. Seek and you will seek in vain. Blessed are those who can rest in prayer, who can rest and trust, and who can say, okay, whenever you feel like coming, come. I'm not in a hurry. The East is not in a hurry. The East has no time consciousness. It says, okay, if this life, good. And if you decide to be next life, good, you will find me still here. There is no hurry. The West is too much in a hurry. In the West, the concept of one life has made such a tense knot in the human mind. Only one life? 70 years? 70 years and finished? And these 70 years, 25 years are lost in education. Almost 25 years you will be sleeping. And the remaining saving and going to the office, coming from the office, and the traffic, and the conflict, and the children, and the wife, and the court, and the divorce, all these things. What is left? If you count everything, you will be simply surprised. Not even 7 minutes are left for God. A great hurry arises. Move fast, do something. Otherwise, how you will find God? God is not something to be found. It is something you relax in. It is an inner space. When you are not, it is there. And when you are not only when you are not a seeker. The seeker holds you as an ego. Who is seeking? The ashrama is a totally different concept. You relax. You just be. You do small things. Hungry, you feel, you eat. Tired, you feel, you go to sleep. With no hurry, with no worry, you just allow God to come in his own way and in his own time. This is the concept of an ashrama. If you really want to know a real ashrama, my ashrama is the only ashrama. Because all other ashramas are absolutely corrupted by the Christians. They think they are Hindu, but they are not. Because there is a certain attraction in the Christian argument. It appeals. First, the very idea of will appeals. You have to work hard. The Christians have given a work ethics to the world. Work. Play? Forget about play. Play is for children. You work. You are a grown-up. You work hard. You work your whole life. And then in the end, like a carrot dangling, you will have your reward in the end, and that end never comes. You work and work and work, and you die working. You fall one day in your grave. In the East, we don't have that work ethics. We say relax, enjoy, play, fool around. Have fun. Don't be serious. And the end is not in the end. And the end is not in the result. It is in the process itself. Let me repeat. Heaven is all the way to heaven. Has he not said, I am the way? This relaxed attitude, by and by, helps you to disappear utterly. And when you are not, suddenly one day, you see God is there. And you see, amazed you are, that he has been always there. If you were not seeking him, you would have known him any time. Your very seeking was the hindrance. Because the thought was hiding in the seeker, and you were rushing hither and thither. The monastery is West. The monastery is the argument of the West. The ashram is the East. The argument of the East. And I say you, all other ashramas in India have become Christian because the Christian appeals very much. The modern world is made by the West. The East is no more East. Will helps you to feel more egoistic. Everybody wants to feel he is somebody. And you can feel somebody only if you do something. Just fooling around, you cannot feel somebody. Just having fun, you cannot feel somebody. You have to do something to prove that you are somebody. And then the Christian ethics says religion is service. So go and serve people. The Eastern attitude is religion is not service. Service may come as a byproduct, but it is not synonymous with religion. Religion is meditation, prayer, relaxation. Religion is to go into yourself. If you have arrived deep in your own being, maybe, and that is a maybe, perhaps, you may start serving people. But then service will not be a duty. It will be just a saying. And the East says it is just a perhaps. Because it may not happen to everybody in the same way. Each is so unique. When it happened to Meera, she started dancing. She forgot all about service. Of course, there were poor people. And it would have been more economical if she had served poor people. But she simply started dancing and singing. And I say she did well. If she had served a leper or a poor person, or she had opened a school and has made a hospital, that would have been a great loss. Because her songs are so tremendously beautiful. Her dance has changed the whole quality of human existence. She has pulsated a new tune. No, it would not have been good. It is good that she allowed his own expression. There have been people who never went anywhere. When they became enlightened, they remained under their trees. That's how it happened to them. In the East, we accept the uniqueness of the individual. We don't enforce any ethics on top of him. We simply say, when you have come home, then whatsoever happens is good. Then whatsoever God wills through you, let it be so. Amen. You don't interfere. If he wants to be silent in you under a Bodhi tree, then let him be silent. Through silence, he will create pulsations, which will change the centuries, coming centuries. For thousands of years, those pulsations will help people to attain higher states of consciousness, altered states of consciousness. So don't bother and don't interfere. If he wants to remain quiet and silent, let him be. If he wants to dance in you, let him. If he wants to go and serve poor people, let him. If he wants to become a Meera, good. If he wants to become a Chaitanya, good. If he wants to become a Buddha, good. Whatsoever he wills, let his will be done. But the Christian argument is important. The world is poor, people are suffering, and you are meditating. Go and serve people. It is logical. It appeals to the reason. And the ashrama has disappeared. I am trying to create a new commune. New in the sense because it no more exists. Otherwise it is the most ancient one. It has existed once. Now only the memory remains. Not even the memory. It has disappeared, faded away. A commune where people are simply relaxing and doing their things, moving through their feeling, not through reason, functioning through the heart, not through the head, and taking it easy. Yes, the very word asrama means take it easy. The fourth question, you crafty old bugger, will I ever learn your ways? There is no possibility, sir. Because I have none. I am the way. If you see through me, through and through, then only you will find. If you listen to my words, and that's what you are doing, the questioner is not a sannyasin. If you are just standing outside me, to become a sannyasin means to stand inside me, to become part of my family, to belong to me. I am the way. I am not preaching some way to you. I am simply preaching myself. I am not giving you, handing you over some technique, some method, some way. And if you are trying to figure it out, you will become more and more confused. I can drive you crazy. Either be a sannyasin or escape. If you are a sannyasin, then your madness has a method in it. If you are not a sannyasin, then you will become more and more confused. You will become mad without a method. And when you have become too much confused, if you escape from here, that won't help. I will go on hunting you. You say, will I ever learn your ways? There is no possibility, sir. It is impossible because there are no ways that I am preaching here. In fact, I am destroying all ways. I am trying to take all the ways away from you. My whole effort here is to create an anarchy in you, a chaos. Because your ways are the hindrances for God. When you are in an anarchic state, not knowing who you are, not knowing where you are going, not knowing what is what, in that beautiful chaos, freedom exists. In that freedom only God is possible. I am trying to create a space here. Not a way. I am not making a super highway so people can follow on it. No. I am throwing you into the wild where no map exists. And I am not going to give you any guide. I am not here teaching you certain doctrine. No, not at all. I am trying to take away all the doctrines that you already have learned. I am trying here to help you unlearn the ways so that the way can exist. And the way is not one of the ways. The way has nothing to do with your choice, or with your mind, or with your reason, or with your logic. When you are completely at a loss, the way exists. God exists. Here, it is not a question of any theology. It is a question of love. And if you stand outside, just like a spectator, an observer, you will get something, but that will not be the true thing. And you will get it very fragmentary. And you will get it according to you. And you cannot get me according to you, remember, make it a point. You can get me only according to me, not according to you. That is the meaning of becoming a sannyasin, that you say, okay, now we will take you as you are, according to you. If you take me according to yourself, that will be simply a misunderstanding. Then we are poles apart. I have heard a very voluble preacher was working himself into a frenzy during a sermon on hell and damnation. A little four-year-old boy in the congregation could not take his eyes off the wild figure in the pulpit. Finally, he whispered to his mother, "What will we do if he ever gets loose?" Now a child has his own understanding. He's there listening, but with his own understanding. If you are trying to understand me from your own understanding, you will not understand me at all. You will get some wrong conceptions and notions. And whatsoever you carry from here will be a burden to you rather than a relief. It will disturb you. And it will always create trouble for you. Never be anywhere half-hearted. Either be or don't be. But never be half-hearted. Otherwise, you are committing some wrong against yourself. You can hear me, certainly, without becoming a sannyasin. You can meditate here without becoming a sannyasin. You can remain an outsider, aloof, neutral, and you may think that you are very clever, but you will get into trouble. And I am warning you, then it is at your own risk. The trouble will be that something will start happening and it will never be the right thing. Because I don't trust much in techniques. Techniques are just devices to bring you more closer to me. Techniques are just devices for you to play with so that you remain occupied. I talk to you, but talking is not the goal. I have to deliver something which cannot be talked about. That I can deliver only when I feel that your heart is open. Till the heart is open, I will go on persuading your mind. But whatsoever I am doing with the mind is not the real thing. The real thing has to be delivered to you when your heart is ready, when you are in a deep trust, when you have accepted me. And remember, you will think that that's what I am thinking whether to accept you or not. If you accept me through your own rationalization thinking, that will not be acceptance. You will be still accepting yourself, your own thinking. If you decide that yes, this man seems to be right, and now I am going to take the jump, it is no more a jump at all. You have missed the jump. Now you are still trusting your own thinking that you have decided, concluded that this man is right. Now I go into the journey. You are not going still. The step has to be taken in innocence, not in cleverness. The step has to be taken like a child. The step has to be taken in trust, in foolishness. Yes, I repeat it. Only those who are foolish enough to take the jump will be ever able to find out what is the way. Have you not watched down the centuries this has been happening? When Christ was on the earth, only few foolish people believed in him. Few foolish people. You may call them apostles now, but they were foolish people. Somebody was just a fisherman, another was a woodcutter, somebody was a shoemaker, just that type of people. Not a single rabbi followed him. Not a single professor. Not a single pandit. Not a single respectable man. All unknown, ordinary people. A fisherman, a woodcutter, a farmer, a prostitute, a drunkard. That type of people followed him. And that too was a very limited number. And all the rabbis were against him. They were clever people. They knew. They already knew. All the scholars were against him. In fact, all the scholars, all the rabbis, all the learned people, they conspired. They arranged that this man should be killed because that man was a dagger. And they were afraid. His very presence was fear-creating. Because he was such a alive scripture. Who will listen to these dead rabbis who talk about dead scriptures? He was the way. And these rabbis were teaching so many ways to reach God. And here was the man who declares, I am the way and I am the truth. Come, follow me. All those who are heavily burdened, come to me and rest in me. Now this was too much. You can be here like a learned man, standing by the side, looking by the corner of the eye, not looking directly. Then you will miss. The fifth question. When you wake up in the morning and you hear the birds sing and you smell the air, do you never think, I want just to enjoy that and I don't feel like giving a lecture? I feel it every day. I feel it every day when I listen to the birds in the almonds. I always enjoy it. I always feel the tremendous beauty of it. And that's why I have to lecture every day. Because then I have to sing. My lecture is a song. It is not against the words that I am singing here. It is in symphony with them. This is my way of singing. And trust me, when birds sing, I feel happy. When I sing, they feel happy. It is a bargain. What I am saying to you is not a lecture. Lecture is an ugly word. How can I lecture? This is a song. This is a spontaneous outflowing. It is overflowing. I feel happy, that's why I say so many things to you. In fact, it is not to explain you anything. I'm not explaining. It is simply to convey my joy, my delight in life. That's the way I can dance. These words are my gestures. And listen to me as you listen to a poet or to a bird. Never listen to me as you listen to a philosopher. It is not a lecture. It is not a sermon. I am not pouring morality in you. I am not giving you any shoulds, oughts. I am not giving you any ideals. I am simply conveying that I am tremendously happy. Can't you see it? I am simply conveying that I have arrived. You can also arrive. I am simply making so many gestures. So if one gesture is missed, another may not be missed. If another is missed, I will make 1,001 gestures. Someday, some gesture may hit you in the right moment. Someday, in some moment, you may be ready and ripe, and suddenly it will happen. Listening to me is just a way to commune with me. I am saying, you are listening, there can happen a great communion. When the listening is perfect, total, when you have just become the ears, suddenly there will be an upsurge of energy, a lightning, a satori. You would have understood. And I was not trying to explain to you, and you would have understood. I am simply transferring understanding. These are not explanations. You can miss me only if you are deaf. And many people are deaf. You can miss me only if you are blind. And many people only appear to have eyes. They are blind. A man visiting an insane asylum found one of the inmates with his ear to a brick wall. "Here, take a listen here," said the inmate. And the visitor obligingly put his ear at the indicated position. "I can't hear anything," he said, baffled. "I know," said the inmate. "It has been like that all these years I have been here. I have not heard anything either." But still he is listening, putting his ear to the wall. There are two misfortunes in life. There are people who go on listening to walls, lectures, sermons, priests, popes, Shankaracharyas, people who have not experienced themselves, people who are second-hand, people who are carbon copies. If you listen to them, you will listen for years and you will not be able to find anything. They are walls. There is nothing inside them. This is one misfortune, getting attached to a wall. There is another misfortune. You may be with a Buddha, a Krishna, a Christ, a Muhammad, but you may be a wall. Then he can go on hammering, he can go on saying, and you don't listen. Jesus says so many times to his disciples, "If you have ears, listen. If you have eyes, see. I am here." These are not lectures that I am delivering to you. This is my being that I am sharing to you. Become more sensitive. Become more loving. Become more receptive. Become more feminine. become a womb, and sooner or later you are bound to get pregnant with me. But there are people who really don't want to listen. They have some investment in not listening. There are people who come to listen and yet don't want to listen. They cannot miss listening and they cannot allow it either. When they are not here, they feel that they are missing something. They would have been here. When they are here, they become stiff. They become afraid. They become scared. If they listen too much, if they go into it too much, maybe they will not be able to return back. This is how they go on hanging. They remain in the limbo. I have heard Mullah Nasruddin inserted a classified ad in a local newspaper offering a 100 rupee reward for the return, with no question asked, of his wife's pet cat. That's a mighty big reward for a cat. And in India, observed the clerk accepting the advertisement. "Not for this one," said the mullah cheerfully. "I drowned it." Now there are many people like that. They know they don't want to listen, and yet they come. And they try to listen. They know that they have already drowned the cat, so there is no possibility of its being found again. But still, they go on searching for it. Maybe they are trying to deceive others. But remember, mind it. If you try to deceive others, there is every possibility. Sooner or later, you will be deceived by your own efforts. When others are deceived, you will be deceived by their being deceived. Be alert. You have to take me in tremendous alertness. Only then you will be able to see what is transpiring here. The last question: what are the three most esoteric reasons for your arriving at the lecture at such an exotic number of minutes past 8? This is from Yatri. He is asking why sometimes I am late. I am amazed myself. The reasons are different. I am amazed because I am amazed why sometimes I am not late. Time does not exist for me. It is a miracle how I manage. And he is asking, what are the three most esoteric reasons for your arriving at the lecture at such an exotic number of minutes past 8? First, I am drunk. Second, I am drunk. Third, I am drunk. And the very last question. Can I ask the question before the first, the really, really first question? Since you obviously are not Einstein, why not give up trying to number the questions from the first to the last? That's true. I know no mathematics. But one thing I would like to tell you, even Einstein was not better than me. He was sometimes even worse. Once it happened, he was traveling in a bus. To pay the fare, he gave certain amount of money to the conductor. He deduced the money for the tickets and returned the remaining money. He counted it, just few coins, but he thought that he has been cheated. So he said to the conductor, "What do you think? Are you kidding me? You have not returned the right amount of money back." The conductor counted it again. It was just a small amount. He counted it again. He said, "It is absolutely right." Einstein counted it again and he said, "No." The conductor was very angry and he says, "What is the matter with you? Can't you count? Don't you know figures?" Einstein has reported it in his memoirs. Even Einstein was not such an Einstein. I am certainly not. I get mixed up. First question, second question, and then I forget. That's true. You should be surprised that I don't start from the last question. Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.